You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, June 5th, 2026. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on the show, Labour reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga sits down with Emile Lacombe, a high school teacher and union organizer in Montreal, to discuss why the Labour movement needs to stop hiding behind legal technicalities and start taking direct action to win back its power. Here are Lacombe and Kalugay-Kasuga in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, Emile. Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Hello, Gabriella. I'm glad to be here.
And just to get started, could you tell me a bit about yourself and your organization?
Sure. So I'm a high school teacher here in Montreal, Quebec, in the public school system. I've been teaching since about 2021. Also, I've been a union organizer for the teachers union since 2023. And I'm a member of Alliance Ouvrière, or Workers Alliance, since 2024. So I can talk a bit about Workers Alliance, what it is, and what we do in practice. So it's a workers movement that started in 2022 in Quebec. And we aim to get together workers from different unions, different sectors of the economy, because we believe we have common political goals and we do basically monthly workers' assemblies here in Montreal, but also in other cities in Canada. We organize workplaces, unionized or non-unionized workplaces, to build a militant labor movement that is able to, you know, take on the capitalist monopoly class in Canada and advance our political and economic interests as workers.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. And I'm glad you brought up specifically taking on the capitalist monopoly class, because I know you were present at the anti-imperialist conference held by the International League of People Struggles last week. So I'm curious, you know, what was for you guys the reasoning to have Alliance Ouvrière there last week, and what is the relationship between the worker struggle and the anti-imperialist struggle?
That's a good question. Well, the reason we were there is because ILPS invited us to speak. So that's the main reason we went. But also, ILPS is an organization that we respect a lot. And we have worked in the past with other organizations that are part of ILPS. And we believe that, you know, the struggles of the working class here in Canada is very tied to the anti-imperialist struggles. So there's two aspects, I would say, why that is. Firstly, because the working class here in Canada is multinational, multi-ethnic. So we have people from different backgrounds, maybe people who come here fleeing oppressive situations in their country of origin. We also have a lot of migrant workers, temporary foreign workers who are here on closed work permits, who have different rights than regular workers. A special rapporteur of the United Nations, their specific case, the temporary foreign workers, as a potential of a new form of modern day slavery. So it's important for us to weave that in our analysis of what is the working class here in Canada and how can we fight to defend the interest of the working class. Also, in the past, you know, organizing workers at Amazon warehouses, in hospitals, in schools, we worked a lot with migrant workers and also, you know, non-migrant workers that get together in the same workplace organizing initiatives. And that's been great for, you know, breaking through this artificial divide that the capitalist monopoly class pushes on us, this idea of like culture war or like migrants versus Canadians. So that's I would say one aspect of why it was important for us to be here. And also, you know, Canada is an imperialist country. It has interests all over the world, in Haiti and the Philippines, with a lot of mining companies having their headquarters here in Canada. So I think one of the ways for us weaken Canadian imperialism and help countries around the world that are being oppressed by Canadian imperialism is to fight for political power for the workers here, right? So if we weaken the bourgeois class, the capitalist class here in Canada by building worker power, in the end, we're going to help, you know, the people around the world who are being oppressed by Canadian and American imperialism.
Yeah, and I like what you brought up there as well of fighting this kind of artificial divide that is being pushed on us. You mentioned, you know, the Canadian working class is very diverse, multi-ethnic, different immigration status. What are some of the tools that workers and, like, organizers can use to really combat that division that is being pushed on us? Because it is, we are seeing a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment, things like that. It is growing in strength, this divide.
Definitely. I think the best way to fight this artificial divide is, you know, workplace organizing and coming together as workers, despite our differences, whether it be of nationality, of gender, you know. And I think, like, I touched a bit about it, but the example for us that stood out was when we organized the Amazon warehouses around Montreal, you know. There was a lot of immigrant workers in these warehouses, but also a lot of Quebecois and Canadian workers. But in the end, they all shared a common goal, you know, of unionizing to have better working conditions. So there was no animosity between these workers on the question of nationality or immigration status. That's the best way. And also doing our workers' assemblies every month, you know, we get people from different backgrounds. We work often with the Immigrant Workers Center here in Montreal. So I think, you know, putting the class, so like being working class, as the basis for unity and for our common interests, I think that's really how we can go beyond that divide.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I really like what you're saying there about class unity, working class, unity within the working class. I'm going to shift the conversation a little bit now. I was looking at the Workers' Alliance website, and I saw a big thing that is highlighted on the website is to reclaim the tool of the political strike. And so I was hoping we could talk a bit about what that means and what the power is of the political strike. So I guess my first question is, what do you mean when you say the tool of the political strike? What is a political strike?
Sure. So a political strike is when workers will go on strike, do a work stoppage to fight for interests that go beyond just direct material conditions in their factory or workplace. So, for example, you know, going on strike against government reform on healthcare or a government reform on education, or it could be going on strike for permanent status for migrant workers, you know? So it's strikes that go beyond just like the Canadian labor code, which limits, you know, strike action to direct, you know, contract negotiation. And it's strikes that heighten the confrontation between workers and the capitalist monopoly class to really, you know, advance the interest of the working class by, you know, getting rights on their workplace, building a more militant workers' movement. So broadly, that's how I would define the political strike. There's been some small examples in Canada in the recent history. I can think of 2015, 2019 in Quebec, CEGEP teachers went on strike in 2015 against government austerity, and in 2019 for Earth Day. So these were strikes that were outside of contract negotiations, but they were only for one day. So they were mostly symbolic, but we can also think of the example of the Air Canada flight attendants that went on strike last summer and defied a back-to-work order. I think that was an example of, you know, workers going directly against the Canadian Labor Code and the interests of the state or the state repression. And when they did that, when they defied that back-to-work order, they were also standing up for the whole working class, saying it's possible to go beyond this legal framework that they impose on the working class movement.
Yeah, and I'm interested to hear also your thoughts on, how do you think we've got to this point now where, the political strike, you've listed some examples, but they're kind of scattered over the years. What has happened? What brought us to this point where, striking is really within this legal framework through contract bargaining? Where, how did we get here?
Yeah, it's just a few decades ago, being part of a union or having a union in Canada was considered illegal, and just going on strike was an illegal action outright. But now we have Canadian Labor Code, which puts very strict laws around how we can unionize, what workers can and can't do, when can we go on strike, when we can't go on strike. It's been a gain for the working class to have these laws because it protects union organizing, and it protects certain rights for us. But what we have to keep in mind is that it's always a reflection of the power struggle between the workers and the bosses or the state. So if we build enough power, political power, we can put more pressure on the state, and they'll give us these concessions like anti-scab laws, right to strike laws, stuff like that. But it's always they can always overturn these laws and take these gains away from us if we don't engage in this power struggle. So I think what we've seen in the last decades in Canada is, after very harsh union struggles in the 60s and the 70s, particularly here in Quebec, direct confrontation between workers and scabs and the militias, paid by the bosses. We made gains that allowed us to have, these laws, this Canadian Labor Code. But now that we have this Canadian Labor Code, there's been a tendency in the Canadian labor movement for the last few years of relying, I think, too much on legal action and not enough on building, this power struggle and building a militant labor base to defend our rights. So it can look like filing grievances, instead of, doing strike action, when our rights aren't respected, doing lobbying to governments when we don't like new laws that are being passed, instead of, mobilizing large amounts of workers to go on strike against a specific reform. So there's been this tendency towards legalism, legal action that has kind of included us and limited our power and also the militancy of unions. So I think it's necessary to go back to our roots and to build a more militant labor movement, because what we're seeing right now is that the government is taking advantage of the fact that we're disorganized, that we're used to take the legal routes. And the thing is that they have the upper hand on that department because they can change laws. The bosses can hire better lawyers than us. So the playing field is skewed in their favor if we stay on the legal battlegrounds, right? So we need to build a militant base of workers, and we need to build this, critical mass in the labor movement. And that's going to happen, workplace by workplace, union by union.
Yeah, and that actually reminds me of another thing that has been making the rounds in the news cycle right now, which is, the right to strike kind of being under threat in Parliament. I'm curious what your take is on that. You mentioned, this reliance on the legal structures, on the legal frameworks, has made the playing field uneven. How do you think that has affected, the threat to the right to strike in Parliament right now?
The right to strike is always going to be contested by the bosses and by the state and its politicians, because going on strike is the most powerful tool we have as workers. Stopping work, it's the most powerful tool we have to put pressure on the economy, put pressure on the bosses and on the state to show that we are the people who make the country, who run the country, right? If we stop working, goods don't get delivered, there's no more services. So bosses and politicians are really afraid of us using that power. And it's been a contested field, since as long as there's been buses and workers, right? So here in Quebec, we have essential services clause. So certain workers in the public sector can't really go on strike. Like nurses, they have to maintain some essential services even if they go on strike. So that's ways that the state has been finding across the years of limiting our power. We can think of workers in specially important fields like CN workers, dock workers. Usually when they go on strike, it lasts 1 or 2 days, and then the government will pass a back to work legislation, because it's strikes that can paralyze the country, and that really show the importance and the power of the working class. So I think right now we're seeing a more direct attack maybe on the right to strike. We've seen it with flight attendants, how their strike was repressed. We've seen it with teachers in Alberta recently. They were first to go back to work. And it shows us that the government will use any tool to refrain us from going on strike, and to force us back to work when they're tired of our strike action. But I think framing it as the right to strike maybe isn't the right way, because again, we're falling into the legal mindset and the legalist route, right? Where it's not that we want this right enshrined in the Canadian Labor Code, because we know that it won't be respected anyhow. If we want the right to strike, we need to prove it in action and to show it by defying back to work orders. And that's the only way that we can ensure that we have this right.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, what does it look like to actually build that, to rebuild kind of labor militancy in Canada and build up workers' power to take these kinds of actions?
It's a slow process, because there's a lot of work to do, and a lot of workers in Canada aren't unionized, so we have to there's a long way to go for them. But it's definitely, I think now is a better moment, because I think people are feeling very pressured by the heightened cost of living, and there's a lot of conflicts happening around the world that are exposing the nature of our system, how it profits from war, from exploitation, with the genocide in Gaza, with the war in Ukraine. So people are awakening to these realities, and they're at the same time they're feeling pressured because rent is too high, groceries are too high, the cost of transit is going up. So they want to take action, to better their living conditions, and also to have more democracy in the workplace, have a say in the place where they spend the most time. At work, it's a place where we don't really have democracy, where we don't really have a say of how work is organized. We've been seeing it, in Canada in the past few years. The number of strikes have gone up, especially in Quebec. And there's been a few examples of long strike. The employees, the workers of the cannabis, government cannabis dispensaries here, in 2022, they did a strike that lasted almost a year. There's a conscience rising and a natural militancy that is growing, because people are feeling pressured. They feel they need to fight to defend their interest. So I think now is a good time to, build a political movement that will regroup these workers, educate them, make links between workplaces in the public sector. It's a big sector in Quebec, and sometimes we're isolated in our workplaces, so it's important to make links. And also with the private sector, we have, common interests. So our strategy, Workers' Alliance, is, to do workplace organizing, organize unions that are militant, that are democratic, and, that are based on workers, not on union bureaucrats or elected union leaders, and to put these militant unions, militant workplaces in contact with each other through the assemblies, through industrial caucuses, to, eventually exert or use the tool of political strike. I think we're far from seeing a nationwide political strike or a big political strike like the 1919 Winnipeg strike, for example. We need to start with winnable fights in our workplaces. Small, maybe economic struggles that we can win to build confidence in the tool of collective organization. And that way, that's how we're going to build the working class power in Canada. I think I can use maybe an example, a concrete example from my workplace. So I work in a public high school. This year, we got informed that parking fees would be more than doubling for our high school and another high school, which use the same parking. And so we decided, the teachers union and other workers in the school, support workers and professionals to keep using the parking, but not pay the parking fees to put pressure on the administration so that they wouldn't increase parking fees. And after a month and a half of that, our pressure tactic worked, and they didn't increase the parking fees. So it's with these small actions that we start to build, militant culture, militant unions, and eventually we're going to build ourselves up to the political strike. But we need to start where the people are, where what they're ready to do, because we need to win some fights before we tackle on the big issues.
Yeah, that's really awesome. It's congratulations on winning that fight. And it's super cool to see how, the labor movement can continue to grow and build, starting from where we're at now towards a political strike. So, Emil, thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio.
Thanks, Gabriella.
That was Emil Lacombe and Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Thank you so much for that, Emil and Gabby. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's hand things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting with labor news. Last week, members of the NDP and union leaders held a press conference in Parliament Hill calling on MPs to support Bill C-247. Tabled in the House of Commons by NDP MP Leah Gazan, Bill C-247, if passed, would repeal Section 107 of the Canada Labour Code. Section 107 allows the federal government to end any strike if it is deemed to be damaging Canada's national interests. That section of the Labour Code has been used more and more frequently in recent years by the government to end strikes. Most notably, Section 107 was used to end a strike by postal workers in 2023, by CN Rail workers that same year, and also to end the strike by Air Canada flight attendants last summer. Both the NDP and members of Canada's labour movement say that Section 107 infringes on a worker's right to strike. They also say that employees use Section 107 as an excuse not to bargain fairly. Bill C-247 is going through its second reading in the House of Commons. Also this week, Pride Month has started, and Rabble has some great suggestions on how to celebrate with a good book. Rabble has compiled a summer reading list of 5 books by Canadian 2S LGBTQIA+ authors. All Hookers Go to Heaven is a fiction novel by Nova Scotia-born writer Angel B.H. The novel follows Mag, a sex worker from a rural eastern Canadian town, as she navigates purity culture, sexuality, faith, and financial insecurity. Other books include Crooked Teeth by Dan Ramadan, a memoir that chronicles Ramadan's experience as a queer refugee, The Regulation of Desire by Gary Kinsman, A Body More Tolerable by Jay Simpson, and Perfect Little Angels by Vincent and Yoke. Check out the reading list on rabble.ca today to learn more about these books. In provincial news this week, Daniel Smith continues to introduce more and more American-style healthcare into the strained Alberta healthcare system. Smith announced her intention to change the funding model for hospitals to a so-called activity-based model. Under this scheme, hospitals will be paid based on the amount of treatments they prescribe, rather than patient outcomes. Critics warn that this could incentivize hospitals to treat patients who have less serious issues first, so that they can treat more patients more quickly. They also warn that it could lead to hospitals prescribing treatments that are not needed in order to increase their volume of activity. NDP MLA and former Alberta Health Minister Sarah Hoffman said, quote, "Activity-based funding pushes hospitals towards quicker, less complex procedures at the expense of comprehensive care, proper follow-up, and better health outcomes." End quote. In arts news, in an article on Rabble, Doreen Nicol discussed the play American Devotion by Canadian playwright Franca Miraglia. The play shows a hypothetical dinner conversation between Marilyn Monroe, her husband Arthur Miller, and writer Norman Mailer. The play explores issues of stardom, femininity, and expression during the 1950s in America. The play's themes contrast with the political climate of the time. During the early 50s, America was gripped by the so-called Red Scare, a fear of communism that was stoked for political gain by U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy. The play runs from now until the end of June at the Crowes Theatre in Toronto. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki warns that the federal and provincial governments may be cutting corners when it comes to its own rules about land conservation. The federal government has committed to meet an international target of 30% land set aside for conservation by 2030. However, it's using ill-defined rules around what constitutes conservation. In March, Prime Minister Mark Carney recommitted to achieve Canada's protected areas goal with a new nature strategy that identifies at least 8% of the target zones as eligible for other effective area-based conservation measures, or OECMs. Suzuki argues that the rules around OECMs are unclear, and that they still leave open the possibility for land to be used for commercial purposes. Suzuki is calling on the federal government to more clearly define OECM criteria and report on conservation outcomes, not just percentages. As always, you can read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Here's a small sneak peek of our most recent bonus content on Patreon.
You know, we were always told like the nuclear family was the ultimate goal and how you had to construct your life in order to enjoy the later years. But I really think this idea of if you don't want that and if you can't have that, it doesn't mean that we can't have this beautiful life with our friends and sort of making it what we want. And that's something that for all the articles about avocado toast and whatever, all the negative things, the entitled generation, I think something that is our strength is our resilience and our adaptability and our willingness to change what doesn't work for us.
Visit us at patreon.com/rabble to hear more. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week.